an alien starship with an insatiable curiosity about Earth's science fiction and fantasy trivia. The crew, two hapless astronauts who have spent their lives immersed in strange new worlds of the imagination. Now, Rob Wickings and Clive Ashenden roam the universe, trying to find the way home, seeking to define the A to Z of SFF.
All the angst and the drama and all is really great, isn't it? But I love Studio Ghibli best of all, and all that stuff's just so lovely, and it's so full of magic and mystery and wonder and greatness. And let's talk about one of those, shall we? Let's talk about Howl's Moving Castle. Let's talk about that, shall we?
Yes, yeah. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Studio Ghibli completely on board with that. Their curiosity, it's possibly the pinnacle of the Japanese animation. I don't want to say genre. Genre's not right. Medium, is that the way to put it?
It's a way to put it. I mean, it's just beautiful animation, isn't it? Mm. I mean, I wouldn't even just sort of say it's the pinnacle of Japanese animation. I'd say it's the pinnacle of animation at that time.
Mm. Yeah, for definite. Yeah. I mean, Ghibli, obviously incredibly well known for fantastic work like Nausicaa and Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away. But Howl's Moving Castle is an incredibly good choice. For all sorts of reasons, really. It's a wonderful meditation on all sorts of different aspects of the human condition. But, primarily, I guess it kind of works as a fantastic anti-war fable, I guess.
Yeah, it does. And there's an interesting bit of kind of cross-cultural conversation going on, I guess, because this is an adaptation from the novel by Diana Wynne Jones, the Welsh authoress, and obviously Hayao Miyazaki, the writer, well, the adapter and director here, would go on to adapt, or the studio would, The Borrowers, wouldn't they, to Arrietty?
Yeah. So this is kind of. Would I be correct in saying that this is the first Ghibli film that kind of took extraneous source material and kind of made it their own?
I wouldn't want to swear to that.
okay.
But I think it's the first sort of Western source material.
Yeah. That's very rough. So.
So I guess we should probably talk about the story.
Yes, we should. Howl's Moving Castle is set in a kind of mythical kingdom where magic and technology go hand in hand, and it's a society that's the kingdom in which our heroine of the piece lives is at war with another nation, and what we basically get here is a situation where the heroine, who starts off as a little girl and becomes an old woman for reasons that will become, well, if not apparent, then at least visible, becomes a linchpin in the war, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, it's you've got this world which is set up as almost like a kind of steampunk world, this kind of Victorian stroke Edwardian sort of level of technology, and it's a bit amped up because, you know, you've got sort of airships as well as kind of ironclads and things like that, and at the same time you have wizards and witches. So it's this really sort of potent mixture of and it, which gives it a sort of really nice sort of unique visual look, I think. But really, the heart of it is, as you say, is Sophie, who is this sort of, a girl who's just sort of resigned herself to her place, her lot in life. She's kind of, because of her father has died and has sort of left his sort of millinery business to the mother and the daughters. She's the oldest daughter. She sort of feels like she has to sort of keep up that, because it's like the only piece of him still going. And she's very competent, and she doesn't really question it, and she sort of feels like she's just she thinks of herself as plain and unremarkable, and that she just does what she does. And then her world gets turned upside down when she meets Howl, the handsome, mysterious wizard who comes in, kind of sweeps her off her feet, but at the same time, him sort of sweeping her off her feet and sort of plonks her into the middle of this war, and gets her the sort of attentions of the wicked witch of the waste, who curses her to turn into this old woman.
Now that. This sort of transformation thing is something that you see an awful lot in Miyazaki, where you get heroes and heroines that are the one thing, and then they're turned into something else, and that almost becomes kind of a way for them to move on. And you get that very much certainly here, in that Sophie's turned into an old woman, but that's not that's almost like the making of her in a way, because she becomes more able to speak her mind, and she becomes more able to be forthright in her opinions and do what she feels is right.
Yeah, she takes the incredibly bold step to go off and sort of pursue Howl's moving castle, which, as you might imagine, is a castle which physically moves along. It walks along on legs. It's this sort of strange steam powered sort of, but yet magical, sort of almost shambolically constructed tower, isn't it?
Yeah.
Things and which is sort of, even from the sort of like opening, when everything is quote unquote normal, it's just there in the background, sort of like away from the sort of gleaming spires of the city. There is sort of puffing away smoke in the background. So, yeah.
I mean, it kind of reminds me a little bit of the Baba Yaga myth as well. The idea of the house that sort of walks around on chicken legs, and Howl's Moving Castle very much does that. It's not elegant by any means. It stumps around on these huge sort of steam powered armatures, but it's very ungainly, and as you say, steam pumping up everywhere. It's this kind of weird techno magical organic-y kind of structure that's sort of part fortress, part, I don't know what else you call it really, it's definitely part animal, helped no end by the fact that it's actually powered by a fire demon called Calcifer.
Yeah, who's part he's part sort of story beat and part kind of like wonderful comic relief character. And and that's kind of, and that's sort of Sophie's first test, really, is can she is how does she deal with this fire demon? And the answer is quite well. So, and that's really what enables her to stay. You know that, and she kind of she befriends the young sort of apprentice wizard who's there, and they kind of form a sort of makeshift family, all trying to look out for Howl, who is this sort of, we find out, as this tormented soul who also, you know, transforms his form, but in this case into a sort of monstrous sort of man bird thing, which he uses to go out and sort of try and stop the war single-handedly.
Yeah. Now, the thing about Howl is that he's seen by his king as more of a weapon than anything else. And part of the tension that you get through Howl's Moving Castle is the attempts by the king to actually persuade Howl to properly take sides and become part of the effort against the enemy kingdom. And this is part of the whole anti-war thrust of the story, I guess, is in that the main character, you know, sort of starts off slightly villainous, but the reason he's sort of seen as an antagonist is because he's kind of anti the war, which is initially sort of again made to be sort of the right thing to do. It's the war against the villainous other, and of course the whole point to war is that they're in certainly in Howl's Moving Castle is that there is no point to war, and that's kind of what Howl in his guise as this monstrous bird is trying to solve. He's trying to stop the war without becoming massively involved on one side or the other.
Yeah, and sort of obviously stuck in the middle of this, you have Sophie, who, as part of her curse, she can't tell anyone that she's cursed. So she can't ask for help of Howl, although he does eventually discover, you know, her true identity when he sees her sleeping, where the curse is apparently sort of lifted for a few hours. You get these rather sort of nicely sketched almost sort of satires of kind of like militaristic states and sort of you know, men with mustaches going out to do to fight the good fight. And it's very kind of, you know, sort of pointed in that way, and Miyazaki sort of really makes a point of this, and at the same time, you know, you realise underneath it all, it does seem to be very much about sort of wizards and witches sort of playing games with each other, you know, and they're just sort of they're very much kind of humouring these sort of stupid monarchs, really, because although the king wants Howl, or well, whichever nom de plume he's going under, to sort of declare for him and sort of, you know, help him in the fight, it's really his you know, his sort of chief witch, who's the person that actually trained Howl, who's the kind of power behind the throne.
Yeah, Madame Suleiman is very much that kind of Machiavellian character, I guess, and she's very much the one, she's almost kind of the motor behind the war, really. You know, she's pushing and prodding and trying to force things in one direction when Howl's obviously trying to work things in another direction. And as you say, Clive, it's very much that case of opposing magical forces kind of just using their own agenda, and it doesn't really matter who else gets in the way, despite the fact you have this war that could potentially could ruin both kingdoms. But, you know, it doesn't matter if there's a point to be made by either Suleiman or Howl.
Yeah, and it's that thing of that you get in you know, I think a lot of good sort of fantasy stories that focus on sort of magic is this idea of these incredibly powerful people who are so immersed in their world of magic, and, you know, whether it's scholarly learning or or experimented with potions and spells that they kind of lose touch a bit with humanity. You have this kind of almost sort of queenly character who's sort of the sort of power behind the throne, and it's just sort of, but it just does seem to be like she just does it, you know, at any time she could click her fingers and sort of take over, but she doesn't, she just chooses not to. And then at the same time you have Hal, who's sort of, who because of a deal he's made, is sort of feels, you know, has become kind of embittered and sort of disgusted with humanity, sort of as withdrawn from it, you know.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that deal is kind of an intriguing one all to itself. It's, you know, not wanting to give too much away, but it kind of explains why he and the fire demon Calcifer, who runs, who powers the castle, are kind of intertwined and what's gone on there. And yeah, like you say, it does sort of explain why Hal's kind of retreated a little bit from humanity. But you know, there's kind of a greater point to be made again in the decisions that are kind of made above and beyond what's going on with the politics of the age. Again, there's reasons for all of that which may or may not be understandable to us.
Yeah, it's that thing which I think kind of, you know, resonates with people, you know, and still kind of resonates even now, which is that thing of the when kind of at a certain level sort of politics, and especially the politics of war and conflicts, seems to become so kind of knotted and convoluted that it has its own sort of, you know, logic it becomes very difficult to penetrate. And so the idea that, you know, sort of magic functions in very much the same way, sort of, I think works well.
Definitely. I'm a great believer in the idea of magic having consequence, which you see in a lot of the really great sort of fantasy novels, you know, things like, even going back to sort of T. E. White's kind of Sword in the Stone thing, you know, magical decisions don't, you know, it's like every action has an equal and opposite reaction, if you like, and that's very clearly made here in the, you know, choices made do resonate back over decades or many years before you know, the realization of what one simple magical act can have echoing forward, if you see what I mean.
I do, and that's why Sophie becomes so key, because, you know, this, you know, a magical act is done to her, which is kind of the thing which sort of propels her, you know, into this world, and it's how she reacts to that. It's the fact that she kind of rolls up her sleeves, well, quite literally, when she starts cleaning.
Yeah.
Right. And just gets on with it, you know, and just sort of, and doesn't let it sort of put her down. She's just like, okay, well, I'm just going to, you know, make the best of this.
Yeah, this is me.
And you know, I'm going to sort of, you know, I'm not going to let this beat me, which is like a wonderful kind of empowering thing. And this, you know, because a lot of what has kind of propelled the story before, you know, the backstory, is this idea that people feel that they've made choices and now there's no backing away from those choices, that they're stuck. And Sophie doesn't, you know, doesn't go with that at all. She's like, okay, I may be in this situation, but I'm not necessarily accepting that I have to stay in this situation. I'm going to make the absolute best of it. And, you know, she sort of creates a place for herself within Hal's Moving Castle, and, you know, actually becomes quite proud of her work, even though it's, you know, to an outside eye, you know, it would look, you know, like she's just doing menial things, but actually she's doing very important things. And, you know, which is not to say that she's some kind of, idealized character, because at one point, you know, when Hal sort of, you know, it basically sort of berates that he can't, you know, he hates the idea of not being beautiful anymore. That's sort of, you know, the fact that he's so self-absorbed and can't see what is going on, that kind of, like, she has a moment where she just starts, you know, she walks out and starts crying, and it's like, I don't want to be in this place anymore. This is, you know, stupid. And it's just, and it's like a lovely moment where you realize that, yeah, she is still quite young, right?
Yeah.
You know, inside, because you got used to her being this sort of super capable, you know, 90-year-old looking woman. But it's this sort of, you know, that she does, and, you know, she still has that heart inside, you know, and which is why, you know, I think the love story is also, you know, ultimately works really sweetly.
Mm, absolutely. There's a tremendous amount of sort of resonance and, well, there's a lot that goes into that you can get out of Howl's Moving Castle anyway. You know, if you want to talk about the anti-war message, that's very clearly there, front and center all the way through it. But you do get this thing about how old age doesn't necessarily have to be the end of the story. If anything, it can be the beginning of something new. As you say, Clive, it's also about the idea of taking what could be a potentially awful situation and not just making the best of it, but, you know, being able to possibly make something new and fresh from that as well. So there's a lot going on there, and all wrapped up in this absolutely beautifully animated story with some really fantastic characters, some really smart writing, and the whole thing just hangs together so amazingly. I mean, you know, Miyazaki, as we all know, is just one of the extraordinary geniuses of film animation and an extraordinary filmmaker in his own right. And this is one of those stories that I don't think you could tell in any other way, as you know, it has to be animation just because of the way that everything sort of blends together so beautifully. And this fantasy world just is presented from the off as just a fait accompli, and you just completely buy it. And that really helps the themes that are embedded within it to sort of resonate more clearly.
It does. I mean, it's, you could almost pick any one of Miyazaki's films and go into how visually brilliant it is. And you know, the quality of the animation, the brilliant choices that are made in terms of score, and, you know, just how the story is told. But what I think, what ultimately, you know, is sort of, I think, they're deceptively simple. And that's like the hardest thing to do in storytelling, it's almost like gossamer light, the touch here and the sort of tone throughout. And you almost don't feel like you're being drawn through a story. You're just kind of floating through it. Right. And there's the pacing, the tone, everything is spot on. I mean, even, you know, whether you're watching the original language, version with subtitles, or whether you're watching the English language version, which is pretty good. You know, it's got some really great voice talents in there. You know, people like Gene Simmons, Christian Bale, Lauren McCall, Blythe Danner, Emily Mortimer, Billy Crystal, rather. And, you know, whichever version you're watching, it still comes across this kind of beautifully kind of Miyazaki touch, really.
Yeah. I don't think there's any other way of putting it, really. You know a Miyazaki film from pretty much the first frame, and this, I'd say Howl's Moving Castle is probably the quintessential one. It's probably the one that I'd recommend almost immediately if you wanted to get anyone into Miyazaki. This would be the one to do it on, and the treats in store from you from there on are just almost too vast to to enunciate, certainly within the confines of this particular podcast.
There are certainly kind of darker and more adult films that he's made, and at the same time there are also sweeter and sort of, you know, more kind of childlike tales as well. So this is as you say, it's almost becomes quintessential just because it's sort of in that sweet spot in the middle, right? You know, it does go to some dark places, but it never really feels like it's fully, although it deals with war, it doesn't go quite as dark as, say, Princess Mononoke.
Very true.
Curiosity, what do you think about our take on Howl's Moving Castle?
Oh, guys, thank you so much. Yes, absolutely. I think Howl's Moving Castle is just the greatest Miyazaki. It's just such a beautiful piece of work with so much else going on. And, I'm a little bit in love with that Howl. Always a bit foxy, isn't he? Even when he's not being foxy, he's being a hawk or whatever he's being. So, yeah, we love it. And we think everyone should watch it and watch it again and watch it one more time just to be sure. It's great, isn't it? I know the planet where Howl's Moving Castle lives. So I think I'm going to fire up the engines and I'm going to take us there right now. Okay, right, see you later, guys. Okay, bye!
Ba-boom.
The A to Z of SFF was written and performed by Rob Wickens and Clive Ashenden, with additional voice talents of Maria Thomas. Music and editing are by Dalil Hallo of the Creation Station of Cavishing. All the waveform you can eat. Do you want to know more? Search for the A to Z of SFF on iTunes, Facebook and Twitter, or check out www.theatozofsff.com.